Blog Talk Radio.
Another great episode here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's topic, what the dog knows, the science and wonder of working dogs, with very special guest today on the show, Kat Warren. So now, here's your host, everybody, Jan Burke.
Well, thank you very much, John, and I am so pleased to be talking today to Kat Warren, especially because this is a subject near and dear to my heart. We're going to be talking about cadaver dogs and human remains detection dogs, as they're known more currently, I suppose. I think there's even a third name now. Kat can fill us in on that. Back in 1996, when I was researching bones, I was in a class about forensic anthropology and listening to a very knowledgeable expert talking about discovering clandestine graves. And he introduced me to this whole idea of cadaver dogs, I and my fellow class members. And during this, we just were fascinated by it. And during this lecture, he said that their dogs every now and then had to find a living person or they became depressed. And all of us in the room went, oh, and I heard myself make the same, oh, sound. And I, being a writer, you know, said, why did we all make that sound? And, of course, as I did further research, found out that this was total nonsense. And here to talk about not just that nonsense, but the realities of the science and wonder of working dogs is Kat Warren, who's written a really wonderful book. I recommend it to any of you who love dogs, who love forensic science, who are interested in police work with dogs, who are interested in the military use of dogs, any of these areas. Mystery lovers, all of you will love this book. It's very accessible, very well written. And Kat, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jan. It's a delight.
So good to be here. So let's start off with we can get back to that myth I just mentioned, but talk to me a little bit about what do we know about how dogs do this kind of work?
Well, we know a lot about the fact that they can do this work. We have some knowledge gaps in exactly what they're smelling. So you talked about the fact that we are sometimes calling human remains detection dogs. Cadaver dogs started out being called body dogs, and then they were called cadaver dogs, and some people still use that term. And now we have human remains detection dogs, and there's a new FBI term, victim recovery canine. Yes, or more obliquely, VR canine. But all of these terms essentially mean that you have a dog that is able to recognize the scent of human remains, and for a large group of those dogs, it's a range, right? These are dogs that can detect anything from dry bone or teeth up through somebody who is fairly recently dead. So that's what we're talking about, and it's a skill that's been around mostly since the early 70s in the United States.
Well, one of the things I loved about this book is that it is sort of a mixture of memoir, about you and your relationship with your dog Solo, and how that got you into this. So you do a great job of intertwining your personal experience with a very high drive dog really great information, very solid information about the many kinds of work that dogs do in connection with law enforcement and forensic science and other kinds of areas of this particular type area of working dogs work. So to talk a little bit about that, maybe tell me about Solo and meeting Solo and deciding that this is what you were going to do with him.
Well, I had no idea that this was what I was going to do with him. It was quite accidental. I mean, not entirely accidental in that he was, as you say, a very high-drive puppy, and he arrived in our house like a little hurricane when he was 9 weeks old, and he was a singleton, which meant he didn't get along well with other dogs. He was emotionally stunted. He was dog aggressive. And he really did flunk out of several puppy classes, and I took him to a trainer who had done search and rescue and other kinds of training, and I knew her in the past. And it was she who suggested this work, which I had no idea existed. And she said, why don't you train him as a cadaver dog? And he was 4 months old at that time, and Nancy was very clear that one of the advantages of doing this for me and for him was that because I was a university professor, I couldn't drop everything for search and rescue and go herring off in the woods because I couldn't necessarily leave the classroom. And she said, you know, these are the kinds of things you can schedule. Plus, you know, and you know this well, Jan, through your research, is that cadaver dogs work sectors rather separately. The dogs aren't out there like in a dog park. And it was a kind of ideal job for a dog with a good nose. Of course, I had no idea what I was getting into. And I think that Nancy had no idea that I would stick with it. She told me later that she was just trying to distract me.
Well, I think what you bring up is a really important thing to get across to people who are interested in taking their dogs into search work or into cadaver work. That, first of all, okay, for those listeners, see, I'm so used to being a writer talking to readers. But to those listeners who may not understand this, the search and rescue are going out to look for people presumed to be, in any case, living at the time they are missing, and to probably or possibly be able to be found living. So there's an urgency to find, say, a Boy Scout who wanders off from his troops into the woods. And as you say, that kind of thing would mean drop everything, get out there, because exposure and all of these other things may change their condition rapidly. So that's sort of one area of work with dogs. And cadaver work is quite different, because there you're looking for someone who's most likely it has not survived
that's
in
right.
that case. Right.
That's right.
So, but this can be a very time-consuming kind of training, actually, in either case. But what do people who say to themselves, you know, I have a really wonderful dog. He finds, you know, all kinds of things. If I hide things from him out in the backyard, he finds them. And that dog is, you know, noses are a big part of any dog's life. So what kinds of things are you looking for in a dog that's going to be, say, just a dog enjoying his nose and the way dogs do, and a dog that you're looking for this kind of work?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a couple of things that you have to think about. One is, of course, that One of the things I try to explain in the book is that it's never just about a dog, right?
Mm-mm.
It's always
no.
about a dog plus a handler, plus really good trainers behind that handler. And in a way, what you're always thinking about is the fact that you're out there as a kind of team. And there are – dogs have good noses. There's just no doubt about it. But on top of that, they also have to have that ability to work and concentrate and not get distracted and be in fine physical condition. And they have to have had – and I think that people don't think about this, but – a lot of exposure to a lot of different kinds of surfaces and distractions. I mean, very often when you're going out on a search, the conditions are pretty miserable. You're taking a dog into junkyards or back in woods where they're dealing with critters. On a search not all that long ago, we got up a coyote, And the fact is that under those circumstances, you have to have a dog that's still willing to say, I'm more interested in finding the dead stuff. And I think that – I think it's wonderful to think about using your dog for something. And I think that there are lots of needs out there. But I think that people also have to realize that – and I didn't realize this at the beginning. I mean – it transformed my life in many ways. I didn't start out that way.
Right.
But
this is not something you do in a weekend training course, right?
No. And, you know, I am still learning, Jan, and I've been now working with Solo for nine years, and it's still a very, very serious hobby for me, right? I have a full-time job. And I feel as though I'm still learning every time I go out. I learn something new. So isn't something that you can just do on the fly. It does take partly because it's not just about the dog. It's a huge learning curve for the handler as well.
Right. So you're going to have to... I'm assuming, in part, in addition to whatever training the dog is getting, you have to learn to read that dog and what the dog, since unfortunately we have not yet reached the point where they have the little talk boxes like they did in the, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the app, the movie where, you know, the dog can say squirrel when it sees a squirrel.
but we don't
have these little talk boxes yet. So you have to instead learn to read the dog.
That's right. Because in a way, it reading a dog and paying attention to what it's doing and learning how it works is distinct with every dog's. The canine sergeant who was my mentor, Mike Baker, used to use Solo to demonstrate to new law enforcement canine officers how to look at a dog's body language because he said Solo was so easy to read, and it's really true. And so Solo gets a pretty distinct crook in his tail. He has a way of throwing his head. My new pup is actually more oblique in some of her indications. And it's just a little subtler. Solo was like a perfect beginner dog for me. But you're getting those language and body changes even before you get the dog to do what they call a final indication or an alert, right? For Solo, that's a down. But long before that happens, I can see his body language change. And that changes then how I search.
Can you give us some examples of what the dogs can do in terms of how I think part of this also is the cooperation of the people who are setting the search up. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. But
yeah.
So we have people who are going to outline for you where they think you should be searching, right? So.
Right, right. Yeah.
Excuse me. Gosh, sorry, everyone.
Oh,
yes.
No. I've got a little bit of it, too. At least we can't catch it over the phone lines.
Okay, so that... So in one chapter, for example, you talk about water searches, and I think that's something most people are surprised to hear the dogs can do.
Yes, and, you know, a land cadaver dog or a dog that searches on land can also be trained to search on water, but it's a slightly different skill. And you're doing the same thing that you do on land, except that you're basically hobbling the dog and saying, instead of running to the scent, you have to tell the boat driver where to go. And if you think about a body, and let's just say it's a small lake that's 30 feet deep, and you have a body that's on the bottom, two-thirds of the way across. That body is giving off gases just as it would if it were on land, and those gases are coming to the surface and drifting across the surface. And sometimes you even will get oils from the body coming up. And those give scent. And if you have a boat zigzagging back and forth, if you think of a cadaver dog sort of like a hunting dog quartering back and forth, and you have a boat doing the same thing, all you do is that the dog is saying when it's getting into scent, and it essentially moves from one side of the boat to the other and helps steer the boat into where that scent is the strongest. So I think that good water cadaver dogs are just irreplaceable, because I think people don't realize how hard it can be to find a body in water. And if you think about how dangerous it can be for divers, and in a way how very often water is murky or, where scent moves, and how bodies move in water, then it's a pretty important function to have a good water dog.
And there are actually tables, I guess, or studies of how bodies may position themselves in water, or at what rate they may decompose, or depending on, I'm assuming, temperature, season, depth of the water,
diet.
What else is in the water with it, predators.
What somebody drank. There's a very famous trainer and handler, Lisa Higgins, who is in Louisiana, and red beans and rice play a role in how quickly somebody floats. Cajun food, and let's face it, beer can very, very often play a real role. So, so there are float charts that water cadaver dog handlers kind of know by heart.
I think this is an area of all of this that some people may be unaware of, which is that you don't just it's not completely as simple as taking a dog out and seeing what it can come up with at that point. The handler and ideally other members of the team that are looking for the body are aware of all kinds of things, including,
right,
say, how on land, how people get lost.
Yes.
And things they, you had mentioned in the book, I think, about people with Alzheimer's wandering differently.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. And, you know, actually, it's some of the people like Andy Rebman or his wife Marcia Koenig can give very numerous examples of Alzheimer's behavior being very different. And an Alzheimer victim will go straight into the thickest thicket in the world and just disappear into it with no sort of sense of backing up or saying, you know, I should stay on the deer trail, or, and if it's a person who's right-handed, they will tend to go to the right. But if it's an Alzheimer's victim, that is all up to their minds in ways that are just ineffable. And so it really, you really do need to know what that kind of behavior is going to look like, because it's going to help you really narrow the areas down where you're going to search.
And I've actually once saw an example of this in just a training exercise where, unfortunately, the victim had been missed, and it was sort of later realized that that was because, instead of believing the dogs, who were all saying, over here, people thought they had been sort of excited by a hobo camp, a camp of transients camping out near the place where the person had ultimately died. But, you know, the dogs knew. The people didn't have all the info. I think the victim's wife was hesitant to say he had any form of dementia. He was, I'm sure, had already passed away by the time they were looking for him. I don't think it would have saved his life, but you know, they felt the frustration of having the people I'd watched had felt the frustration of having missed it.
Yes, no, I mean, it's heartbreaking, and I think that that's, I write about this in the book. I think it's every cadaver dog handler's nightmare is missing somebody who's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of a variety of conditions, because of the kind of thing that you talk about. I know any handler, right, is always after the fact going to look at maps and try to figure out, gosh, when the dog lifted his head there, should I have paid attention? And instead, you know, I just didn't notice it. And in the studies that they've done where they videotape people, you can actually go back and see that handlers can sometimes just not pay close enough attention to what their dogs are doing because of a lot of human factors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the dog will give an indication, but for a variety of reasons, you don't see that happening. It's,
right. I mean, you can be out in an environment where you're having to concentrate and yet, at the same time, you know, be careful that you're not cueing the dog or miscueing, I guess I should say, the dog, and minding all of your own handler's P's and Q's, and yet relaxing enough that it's still play and fun for the dog. It is
a marvelous kind of multitasking.
Let's go out
and try to find somebody who's dead and still have fun and not trip over a log or run into a snake. And and always keep reminding yourself, even when the ticks are landing on you, gosh, the dog's here to have fun, so please.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that was also something I was struck by the one of the occasions I went out, is that the dogs, anyway, that I've met who do this work are, a lot of them, you know, if you're expecting them to be something you've seen in a Westminster Kennel show, you know, think again, they're sort of clowns, the ones I've met. I mean, I'm sure there are different personalities among them as well, but a lot of them, you know, I have this great memory of, you know, we're in some mud in Virginia, and they all did, you know, belly flops into the mud hole.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was not the obedience course of little soldiers that I think sort of initially I'd wondered if these highly trained dogs, if that was what I was going to see. So that kind of got blown away pretty quickly.
You know, it's really funny. There are a lot of people who misunderstand. And don't get me wrong, I think that it's really important to have a dog that's well under control and that you can direct in various ways. Mm-hmm. But again, back to my mentor, Mike Baker, I have heard him on numerous occasions basically tell young handlers, stop correcting your dog and making it mind like an automaton right before you're going into a search, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a point where the dog's getting pumped up, and yeah, you want to make sure that it can do the basics, but gosh, you also want to build up its drive and enthusiasm and jerking on its lead and insisting that it heel calmly at your side is not necessarily going to benefit. Now, I mean, there are different dogs. I mean, Solo is a, let's face it, sort of a jerk and a clown. I have seen some very calm, good, methodical dogs that are perfectly happy walking at your side until they get let go. But I know the other model very well.
Well, we will talk more about that in a moment. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to talk more with Kat Warren about what the dog knows.
Thank you.
welcome back, everybody, after the break here of Crime and Science Radio. We are continuing the episode today of What the Dog Knows, the Science and Wonder of Working Dogs, with very special guest Kat Warren. So now, back to the show with your host, Jan Burke.
Welcome back, everyone. And yes, today we are talking to Kat Warren, author of What the Dog Knows. This is newly out from Simon & Schuster. I highly recommend it to all of you, whether you are dog lovers, mystery readers, people who want to know more about police procedure, all those kinds of things, military use of dogs. It's covered in this book. So, Kat, we were talking a little bit about some of the different environments that dogs work in and about how you can't just necessarily take the beagle that can find the hidden piece of bologna and teach it to become a cadaver dog. So let's talk about, you know, in addition to sort of the basics of needing a dog with drive and a dog that is going to be able to physically go into all these different kinds of environments, what is involved in training a cadaver dog? What are some of the basics of doing that?
Well, I could talk a little bit about working with Solo and then with other dogs, but the first thing that you're doing is after you've gotten the dog up and running on all sorts of different environments, you also are going to start introducing that scent to them. And in a way, that foundation work is so important to set up. With Solo, I set up a series of buckets, and one of them had cadaver scent in it. I think that early on it was like a tooth with a little bit of bloody packing. It was it was my trainer's ex-husband's tooth. And she didn't pull it out. It was his wisdom tooth. But what you're telling the dog is the dog goes through the series of buckets, negative, 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 positive. Hooray, you found that. I'm going to reward you. And in a way, what you're doing then is you're exposing them to a broader range. With cadaver and human remains detection, it's probably one of the most complex scents we out there for sniffer dogs, right? So if we mm-hmm. think about heroin or cocaine or even bombs, those are chemically much less complex than human remains. Mm-hmm. So there are so many different volatiles coming off bone or tissue that you really want to train the dog ideally on the range, right?
Mm-hmm.
And and we still don't know. Arpad Voss at the University of Tennessee Anthropological Research Facility, known fondly as the Body Farm, has identified 480 volatiles coming off. Yes, and he thinks it's going to be closer to 1,000 volatile organic compounds by the time they're finished identifying them.
Mm.
So you can imagine that a dog is making a whole sort of set of decisions, because if it's something like dry bone, there are really only a few volatiles coming off dry bone. And
mm-hmm.
you're going to want to say to the dog, I want you to find that, but I don't want you to find deer bone.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Right?
Mm.
So,
right.
So
right,
and
not
we
just
still
any
don't
mammal
know.
Decomposing, right?
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of chemical similarities, but there are also differences, and a dog obviously needs to know the difference, because if you can imagine, there are so many places where you're going to have animal bones competing
mm-hmm.
with human remains
mm-hmm.
on the sides of highways, out in the woods, so. You want to make sure that the dog understands there's a difference.
And so this is something I think sometimes people wonder is, where do you get the training material for that kind of you know, you're obviously not going to just knock off your neighbors so that you can,
different, it's a very good question, and different states have different laws, and they can be very complicated, and so it depends on the state you're in. There are some places where you actually can't have training samples, and people use what are called pseudoscents, which fake scent, and there's a German company that creates those scents, and there's every evidence that those work as well. Dogs can be very good at generalizing, but what's helpful, North Carolina has, I think, pretty reasonable laws. I don't keep tissue, but I, you know, can keep teeth and bone and dried blood. One of the very best training materials that we can have is dirt from underneath a decomposing body. And so because I work with law enforcement, very often if there's a scene that's been processed where somebody's been outside for a while, and once they've completely processed the scene, we will go back and collect a few jars of dirt. And since this is a science show, one of the things that happens in North Carolina is that you get, when people will melt a bit if they're out in the woods for a while, and that adipocere or human fat, right, just stays in the dirt and will stay there for a very long time. So that dirt is quite redolent, and it can be quite effective as a training tool. So those are some samples.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, obviously many of us see death in a very sanitized kind of form. We see, if we've seen a body, it's probably been a body in a funeral home. There was a different time, of course, where people were around the dead more than we are. Most of us are fairly removed from the dead. So what happens, I think, as a part of that is that we lose our understanding of that natural process, which is that nature's just this fabulous recycler, and really from the moment you drop it, your own body goes to work on the recycling plant, essentially. And if you've ever laid a bag of fertilizer, and spilled fertilizer too heavily on one part of your lawn, you've seen that kind of burn, and that's essentially, there's this set of nutrients that are kind of going into the soil all at once. So you'll have a spot, and depending on the climate and a number of other factors, the soil and everything else. But like you say, you're in a generally like lots of woods, lots of insect life. So they'll all contribute to that process. Yeah.
I do, I do like to think, everybody dies, and it's true that it's become pretty sanitized, except on shows like CSI and Bones, where it, in some ways, the Hollywood version is, to me, actually much more grotesque and unbearably unwatchable than what we experience sort of in the reality of search, right? I think that there's a very poetic term for when bodies break down, that they become, quote, less organized and more susceptible to outside influences.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous, yeah. I mean, it's, to me, I mean, I think if you can get away from sort of your preconceptions about it and just think about what ultimately a wonderful kind of process it is, that sort of return state, it's nothing to be frightened of, really.
I understand people's reactions. It's not a reaction that I have, but part of it is that I've become fascinated in this work, and part of it is that, again, for solo, for it to be a good experience for him, I can't transform any of those feelings that I might have down the leash, as they say.
Well, that's a really interesting, brings up sort of the other half of this, because while you're training the dog to respond to these scents, the handler also needs to be trained along with the dog, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what are some of the things a handler needs to learn?
Well, I mean, the handler needs to learn to use his or her mind at the same time that they use the dog in the best possible way. So this issue of not allowing your preconceptions to make you not see what the dog is doing, thinking that something has to be over there when the dog is saying that it's somewhere else, realizing that even in things like if you have clandestine graves, that a dog is not necessarily going to alert right on top of where the person might be, I learned something just some months ago from Arpad Voss, and I hadn't thought about it, and then another searcher, Brad Dennis, talked about it. He is with Class Kids, and he goes on searches across the United States, but he pointed out that with clandestine burials, very often people are out searching right after the person has disappeared, and if that person is in a clandestine grave, it can take up to 11 days for the scent to come up through the soil and reach the surface so that a dog can actually access that. And so right at that point where you have, you know, sometimes a lot of dogs and many, many people searching, you're not going to have scent out there, right?
Right.
It was one of those, again, I've been doing this for several years, and I thought, oh, my gosh, that really makes a difference in whether you should go back into those areas 2 weeks after somebody disappears and research them.
That makes sense, huh? Well, you also talk in the book about, and we haven't even gone into this, but about historical graves and that the dogs can be used in this way also. But in some cases, if enough time has passed, you have another effect, which is that other natural forces are carrying scent, say, through water drainage I know from working with a forensic anthropologist, if you're someplace, people don't realize, I think, first of all, how heavy a dead body is and how inconvenient a thing it is to dispose of secretly. And so there are lots of times where the body may not be buried deeply enough to, say, discourage scavengers from coming up. So part of that is also knowing where might a scavenger have taken the scent or all of that.
I'm afraid that I've been on a couple of cases that have involved that kind of thing. And we have coyote and bear in about 2/3 of our counties. And even smaller critters, raccoons or possums, can carry things a fair ways away. But a coyote or a bear, or even dogs, right? Dogs do this a lot, can really scatter remains for quite a ways. And so it is important to kind of know what the flora and fauna are in a particular region and what you might have in a variety of cases. And you're absolutely right that for many clandestine burials, I mean, people aren't buried very deep. The average depth is, I think the FBI did a study, and it's like 2.5 feet. Mm-hmm. And that's not very deep for a determined animal to actually dig somebody up. not to put too fine a point on it.
If you stop to think about that, though, that's a lot of work in a a forest or someplace
and
that's
mostly,
not like a tilled field or something. You know, that's a lot of work, 2.5 feet for a human size plot. Yeah.
That's right. And very often people are using existing depressions, et cetera, to sort of start that if they bother at all. And so, as you say, and I think that you've done research on this, Jan, but there are a couple of people who have studied scavenging, and it really is a factor.
Yeah, it is. Well, so in the work that you're doing, and I think this is something really important for people to understand, you are not just showing up because you read a news article that somebody's gone missing. Can you talk about how you built that relationship with law enforcement and sort of the guidelines you follow as a professional handler, say, versus what people may sometimes run across in the media, we'll put it that way. That's as kindly as I can phrase it.
Yes. No, and, you know, I mean, I laugh a little bit about it in the book because, you know, every part of me, if I see that somebody's missing and it's on the news and, I so want to be called out. It's what, you know, we train so that we can search. But the fact is that it is, I don't go out unless I get a call, and from law enforcement, because it's what is called self-deployment, and it simply isn't professional. And I'm in a little bit of an unusual situation in that I'm not with a team, and so I train with a couple of different law enforcement agencies here and there, and they know to call me if I'm needed. And so I don't go out a lot. I'm not out there every week searching with solo by any means. But what's important is that when you do get a call, that it be through those sources, through law enforcement, and that I then become very obedient, right? I mean, we discuss the case, and a good agency that knows a little bit about dogs, or even a good agency that doesn't know but will listen, then we can talk about timing, what might be ideal in terms of searches. In North Carolina, it is a big issue during the summer that, when it gets up into the mid-80s and a dog is panting too hard, they just can't access scent as well, right? They can't pant and sniff as effectively. So you want to think about all those things. And so, so a standard search for me starts with a phone call from an agency. And goes from there. And I try to make myself as available as possible, as quickly as possible. But again, I think you noted this, that unlike search and rescue, mostly time is not of the absolute essence. So, an afternoon call can become a deployment in the morning when the temperatures are better.
Right, and there may be more moisture in the air or weather conditions are better.
Exactly.
For search. I also think it's important that people understand, too, that this is very serious forensic work, and what is found is possibly going to become part of a court case at some point. So that means that you can't have a dog that's going to do anything destructive at the site or at least you need to control that as much as possible. And also you, in essence, are part of a crime scene processing team at that point. And so law enforcement has to know that they can trust you to behave in a way that's not going to compromise a case. So.
That's right. That's right. And I think that, you know, once again, some of these rules are pretty, they're pretty basic. They're right. But it's also hard because you want to make sure that the dog doesn't in any way destroy possible evidence, right? All of those, depending on the case, all of those things come to mind. And I think that, you know, I'm not a police officer, but it's important for me to keep up with what the laws are in terms of where it's legal to search and everything else. All of those things come into play when you have a dog and, as you say, a possible crime scene.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about something we sometimes see in the media of, I think, the way we've mentioned it to each other is about the magic dog, the dog that finds everything every time. How does that compare with real life?
Well, you know, it kind of compares with real life like perfect people compare with real life. you know, there are no perfect people and there are no perfect dogs. And I do think that it's enormously important that we not get into this soft, fuzzy edges of thinking that that dogs can do things that they can't. It does good dogs a terrible disservice, and the same for good handlers, because you can't do everything. Dogs aren't capable of being perfect. That's why you train them, right? To try to get them to be better and better. But I think that when people make claims about dogs having super dog capabilities, it does a disservice to the fact that it's a whole team out there, and that you're never depending on a dog by itself. Otherwise, we would just, as I say in the book, we would just let them drive the car to the scene, search, and come back and tell us what they found.
Right? It'd be so much easier than having to get up at the crack of dawn, right?
Wouldn't it? But I think I do think that that some of the outlandish claims that we see in the media and that we see occasionally from a canine handler here and there, by no means all of them, but here and there, does create this outsized expectation of what dogs can do, right? That
right.
I'm going to take this dog and let it loose in the woods, and it's going to search a 2-square-mile area and find what nobody else could find. It's going to, you know, but it doesn't work that way.
I mean, I think one of the things that you had mentioned is that a lot of the time is just saying the dog didn't find anything here, and you know, sort of as you say, clearing the area, and not expecting that that may mean there's nothing there, but just that it wasn't discoverable by that dog with those conditions on that day.
Think, yes. Yes. And I think that Andy Rebman, who is probably the most well-known cadaver dog trainer and handler out there because he sort of wrote the book on this, he said 9 times out of 10, you don't find something. And yet I think it's enormously important that for those 9 times that you don't, that clearing an area can be important. And saying that you're pretty sure the person isn't there, that's just part of basic police work. But I think that it also matters to family and friends of whoever is missing, right? Because if you think about if you have a loved one who is missing, you're going to be out there thinking about all those places where that person might be, right? And it's important for people to go and make sure that that person isn't there.
Right. I mean, I think that's very hard for those of us who may not have been in that position to imagine what a family is going through when a loved one is missing and presumed to have been harmed.
Yeah.
It's a sort of endless torture.
Kathy Holbert, another really fine cadaver dog handler, and she's also bred the pup that I have now. So I was really fortunate to get to know her. You know, she said, you don't tell a family that they need to get resolution. Families don't lose hope. They never lose hope. Even though they know at some level that the person is dead, there are too many scenarios that you can invent, and that's what you do when somebody is missing. Even if you're 99% sure they're gone, you still hold out that hope. And as long as they're not found, I think that the pain goes on.
Well, I want to thank you and your fellow handlers for all you do to help those families to at least know a little more, and in some cases at least be able to bury their dead, which in our culture is more important than many of us imagine. And just also, Kat, thank you for this wonderful book. Again, I want to urge everybody to pick up a copy of What the Dog Knows. It's a wonderfully written book, and I think you don't need to be an expert in forensic science or any other area to fully understand. It's very accessible, very well written. So thank you for being our guest today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure, Jen, and I'm a fan.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So everybody, we want to remind you to visit suspensemagazine.com, click on the Crime and Science Radio button, and you will find more links to the show and everything else that is coming up on Crime and Science Radio. Until next time, thank you again, and enjoy.